I'm Larry Kowalski, and I'm an alcoholic. I have not found it necessary, and more surprising, I haven't even found it desirable, to take a drink or a mood-changing chemical of any type today, or any today since May the 21st, 1972. And I'm very, very grateful for that. In the Gospel of Matthew, in chapter 14, there's a story that very recently has meant for me precisely what the theme of this conference is. That's in the last 3 weeks. It's enabled me to do some thinking that has caused me to do some deep giving thanks, and I'd like to start off sharing that story with you. Followers of the Lord are in a boat, and the waves are high and the wind is strong. And he comes walking toward them, and they don't recognize him. They're scared by this love that's breaking through the storm of life. And he says, "It is I," or "I am he, do not be afraid." And one of the bolder ones, Peter, shouts out, "If it's really you, tell me to come to you across the water." And the Lord says, "Come." And Peter starts walking across the waves. In doing this, he takes his attention off the answer and puts it on the problem, sees how strong the wind is and starts fearing, and he starts thinking, and he has to cry out for help. And the Lord reaches down and lifts him back up, and I'm sure with a little bit of chuckle kind of says, "Oh, you have little faith." And they arrive together safely in the boat. I'm going to come back to this story again and again and again, I hope, in sharing with you to show the insights that it's having, the importance that it's having in my life, but first, let me tell you some things about me. I am, as I've already introduced myself, an alcoholic with a backup problem with drugs. I'm only going to talk about the alcoholism because, to me, they go together. And when I talk about alcohol, I mean alcohol and or any other mood-changing chemicals. My drug of choice is alcohol, but I did use street drugs, including pot. I used over-the-counter pills, and I used a secret supply of tranquilizers to back up my need to chemically escape reality. Secondly, I am a Catholic priest. I want to make that very clear, and I'm going to comment on that in a moment. I'm not in uniform, and the program doesn't carry a title. That's no accident. Third, right at the moment, I'm a full-time student at the law school of the University of Oklahoma. Any one of those three, I think, can be exceptionally time-consuming. Mm-hmm. Together, they just don't allow much time to stop and think. Mm-hmm. And when I'm put in circumstances between the alcoholism and my priesthood and my law studies, where I don't have enough time to think, I don't have enough time to meditate. And I get hectic, and I get pressured. And I start forgetting the disease that I have. And that's where the story that I started with became meaningful for me. Life started losing a lot of its edge. And there wasn't much joy in the meetings that I was going to. And I started thinking about the story. And the story added a whole new understanding to my disease of alcoholism. Before I show you that, I want to comment, as I shared with you, about being a priest and about not wearing the uniform and using the title Father. Where I sobered up, I sobered up in a military town, Lawton, Oklahoma. We had a man in our group who called himself Colonel John at the meetings until he got drunk and came back as John. And I hope he taught me my lesson so I don't have to learn it from myself. Yeah. I think in the hearts of every single one of us, there's this feeling that somehow we're different and that's why the program won't work for us. Or we're different in other ways. And it's just absolutely crucial for me to know that I am a full member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've got the same disease that you do. And therefore, anything that separates me from you will kill me. And so I urge this for my own sake and for the sake of anyone else. I don't care if you're a cradle Catholic with a deep respect for the clergy. Please, should you see me after this meeting or anywhere else connected with our program, I'm Larry. Now, if you're dealing with me in a rectory over church matter, you might attach the title Father. And so I stand in regular clothes, and I stand as the full person that I am because I have a disease that strikes me on the level of my being a person. There's two other side comments on religion that maybe I can share with you that my sponsor suggests. And the first is that when I came to this program, I didn't surrender to God. I was praying when I was being paid every day to celebrate Mass, and nothing was happening. I was getting drunk. If there was a God, I was going to hell. I've heard some priests in our program that I described, and that's where they were at, as St. Joe with a living problem. With a drinking problem, excuse me. That's not me. I broke every single rule I had that I could get to. And I did most of the breaking more than once, again and again and again. So had there been a God that I believe, that I thought existed when I came here, I'm not too sure I could have come here, because to sober up with that God would have meant hell. I surrendered to the program. Shortly after I came into the program, I had a powerful experience. I woke up at peace with myself, and that was the first time that had ever happened. And right away, I didn't say this was Christian, this was Jesus. All I said was this worked, and I walked with what worked. And after about 2.5 years, I was able to bring together what was reality within me and then what was going on in the church. And I was able to make an act of faith that what I experienced inside me was the exact God that was in my church. I think a lot of us are pressured by very sincere people in our churches who feel that by going to Alcoholics Anonymous, somehow we're betraying the Catholic Church, the priesthood, the Baptist Church, some other church. And the last aside that I'd like to have at the beginning deals with that, because maybe coming from a clergyman, what I share that I've had to walk through can help you. And my answer comes from my own real belief that my alcoholism is a disease. And I've come to see that I can't talk with people who don't see it as a disease, but rather as a weakness. We're talking different languages, and we have different major principles, and there's not going to be a possibility of seeing anything in common. But if a person is able to see that somehow alcoholism's a disease, then I think I can usually share with them. Because I tell them that if I had appendicitis today, they wouldn't expect me to go to church and pray the rosary. The solution for appendicitis is medical science as my God has given it. I believe my God heals. I don't believe that any doctor I know really understands how simply cutting and bringing tissue together enables healing to occur. There's something more there. He knows how to do it, but he doesn't know why doing this actually leads to full healing. If I went to a church to have appendicitis handled, I would be telling God, who gave us a normal way for his healing love, that he wasn't to use his normal way. I was demanding he would use a special way, and my God doesn't take good orders. I believe God has given us a normal way to handle the disease that I have, the disease of alcoholism, and that is through and in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. God can, I honestly believe, heal appendicitis directly. I've experienced a little bit of drama of his power in my life since I've sobered up in other areas. I believe God can and does directly heal the disease of alcoholism, but it's not the normal way. And the normal way is through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I certainly believe that if God has brought me to this program, for me then to switch and go to church is for me to change the direction that God has brought into my life. And I'm very certain from my own experience in sponsoring other people that those kinds of solutions don't work. A man I sponsored who had a period of sobriety killed himself. And he killed himself because he found God so powerfully in Alcoholics Anonymous, he dropped us to go to church. And I warned him what was going to happen as far as returning to drinking. And he returned to drinking. And he was one of those people who, unfortunately, never could make it back on the program. And after trying for about 8 months, he killed himself. Let me tell you about me. The most important thing to understand me, half of it is what I began sharing. I'm a sober alcoholic. Let me add on to that. I have serenity today. And in so many ways, I shouldn't. Now, in order for you to understand what's strange about my being sober and my being serene, in order for you somehow to see this, is me walking across the top of the water, you're going to have to understand something about me. I just grew up born in the wrong world. That's the only way really to describe it. I was born into a good family with loving parents. My mother is very, very neurotic. I just spoke with her a while ago on the phone. I can take her for periods of less than 5 days at a time and not walk away deeply scarred again. But I came to see that so much of the pain that she brought into my life, she gave by killing herself working for us. She'd work herself to a frazzle so we'd have a good Christmas and then take it out on us. But grading her as a mother, I'd have to give her a grade in the 90s. And I didn't see this till about a year ago. grading myself as a son. I'd have to give me a grade in the 30s. I've just taken and taken and taken, and it astounded me because I thought I was the victim. I was the martyr. And to see that she really was the much better Christian and the much better loving person really, really, really shocked me. But it's important for me to see that, looking back, to help to understand other people, that the love that was given, I could never receive. And I don't know why. I don't know the whys. I don't know if my mother kept a wet diaper on a half hour too long one day, and that's the start of all my traumas. I just know the what. You know, that I am scarred, and that I am different, and that I am marked. And that's the set of rules that I've got to start walking through life with. And I've got to just know those. I can be given love and not experience it. I'm one of the kind of people who walk around feeling guilty for just being. Not just for the things that I've done, but I feel guilty for enjoying myself. It took me 9 years sober to learn how to play. And it's such a great luxury. I'm planning an 11-day ski vacation between semesters. And just to be able to take time off and do nothing, it's just such a step of growth. I didn't have that for a long time. I'm one of the kind of people who just feel waves of depression. And I mean waves of depression. The kind of depression where it's like a fog that just settles in, and you have like 10 ton of weight on your little finger, so you're too hard. You know you should lift, pick the phone up and dial somebody, but it's too much effort to do that. And those things can last, as I shared, for months and months and months. I experienced tension all the time. I took between 100 and 500 aspirin a month, late in my drinking. On top of 50, I'd used Alka-Seltzer to handle the hangover, so I'd have tons of Alka-Seltzer I was taking, sleeping pills, over-the-counter tranquilizers, and alcohol, all at the same time. And I always had a tension headache. All the time. My stomach was just totally knotted up. I thought this was a standard way to live. And as the pain came into my life, I'd have psychosomatic diarrhea 4 to 5 times a week after the evening meal, never knowing when it would strike. Just as an aside, a real positive proof to me that this program worked was the first time sober I had to take X-Lax. And I share that and people laugh, but I hope you really realize how important bowel control is. I have an older brother who I believe has touches of sadism. He called me Big Ears growing up, Dumbo the Elephant, and a dozen other things. And I grew up feeling I was ugly. Just as a whole and a total person. The very first breakthrough in this occurred yesterday. And it's amazing what an atmosphere of love does. I believe I have a God of love. And love for me isn't a lump that sits somewhere. It's a status. It's a process. It's being loved, being accepted. And when Hardy was singing the Our Father and we were locked in prayer, something happened that I could never do before. I had my eyes closed. And as he was singing that, and I was kind of being in a position of being loved, which is for me letting God be God, I pictured my face. And I've had this test that I've used when people come and do fifth steps with me to tell me what they feel about themselves. I ask them to close their eyes and to picture themselves. And if they can picture themselves, they have a good image of themselves. If they can't, they, like me, for some reason, reject what they look like. They feel ugly. And I've had very attractive people who can't do this, and then listening to their lives, at some period, someone made them feel ugly, and they've never outgrown. They've never been able to shatter that. And it's real neat. This was a byproduct I never even dreamt could be changed in me. That 11 years of being loved could enable me to feel at some point that I am not physically ugly and that I can accept my look. You know, I'm never going to be a Robert Redford, but, you know, you can only go so far. But it was a great step forward. So I felt ugly. I had no one my own age that I grew up with on the block and might have had a... So I was tagged onto my brother and went to play with kids 3 years older than me. I couldn't shoot basketball the way they could. I couldn't hit a baseball the way they could. I couldn't play football the way they did. And so I was a failure. And I thought I had no athletic ability till at the age of 45, I put skis on for the first time and flopped completely. But at the age of 46, became a good green skier. And at the age of 47, became an excellent, I'll even use that word, intermediate skier. And that just shattered another thought I had about myself, an area of being a failure. I started first grade a month and a half after I was 5 years old. I graduated from high school at 16, never missing a grade, and college at 20. I performed well academically, but I never knew what everybody else was talking about, and I'd have to pretend I did. And this was my whole attitude toward living, pretending I understood how the rest of you were making it through life. and never being part of the in-group, never being wanted, the kind of person that never got called, the kind of person that I'd have to travel a mile to find the friends, and I was always on that outer circle of life and trying to have to beg for life to accept me. I never had a moment of wanting to be Larry. At the age of 14, I hit bottom and sometimes watch slogans because they have a lot of meaning, but they're not always universal. What I'm going to say, I say with 11 years in this program, at the age of 14, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And the only reason I'm here today is I could not kill myself. I want to also share that because sometimes we don't hear this. I believe the great majority of us are in our programs because for whatever reason, we do not have the viable option of suicide. If we had, we'd have killed ourselves before we came to AA or Al-Anon, which shows what the world thinks of what we think of our program in some ways. And that's going to be important because it's going to add on to certain other elements to lock us into a situation where we don't have any choice at all. I have to work this program because, first, if I go back to drinking, I am deathly afraid of living drunk. I have never been afraid of dying drunk. That's what I wanted. And I heard Clancy say this, and I was a year and a half sober and my stomach turned. He talked about telling newcomers that if they go back out and drink, they're going to die. And he said, think about it. Isn't that what you most wanted near the end of your drinking? So why tell a newcomer that the answer is there? Because it isn't. A few drinking alcoholics are lucky enough to die. Most of them live in that. They live in that hell, and it only gets worse. And what we ought to tell people is the truth, and it's what I'm sharing with you. If you choose to drink, I don't like that phrase because I disagree with it. If you choose not to work your program, and so put yourself in a position where it's impossible to continue to be on top of the water and you go back to drinking, you are going to return to the hell you were in. You are going to stay in that hell for a long period of time, and it is only going to be worse. And there's no good news in that at all. There's nothing light to that at all. I couldn't kill myself. And I searched around for any possible answer I could find. I tried everything. I tried activities. I tried a profession. I tried a geographical change. I tried money. I stowed every cent to the poor fund I was in, the first church I was assigned to for 3 years running. They don't make you saint of the year for that, I'll tell you. And none of this helped this inner pain. I just kept dying in here. There was just no answer. And then I found my answer. And it was alcohol. And that's also very important for me to say. You know, sometimes what we hear is so much of the pain of what drinking did that we forget one important thing. Alcohol is not our problem. It certainly wasn't mine. Alcoholism, this whole inner set of feelings, this inability to just live today unchanged, this absolute need to run from being Larry, that's my problem. And the best answer I ever found was alcohol. It's the only answer I found that handled the problem. I thought, but it didn't. It drugged me to the pain. But it was the only effective drug I had ever known. And before I came into this program, the only moments of my life that weren't filled with pain were the moments when I had alcohol and or drugs, of course, alcohol in my system working. Fortunately for me, I'm an alcoholic. And I therefore have a bodily inability to control alcohol. And I say fortunate because if I weren't, I probably would have spent the rest of my life drugging myself and never knowing that there was an answer, that I didn't need to be drugged, but that there was an answer to just be Larry. I started losing control, and I'm not going to get along drunk a log. I just got to share enough to let you know how amazing it is that I'm on top of the water. I belong to the category of alcoholics who never really liked the taste, who drank solely for the effect, who are and were alcoholic from the first drink. I didn't get drunk all the time, but I've never put a glass down content, half drunk, and walk away from it. It still angers me. I feel embarrassed to share it, but it's part of my own phrase. I don't like sharing it because it can offend some people who may have had an experience with this or someone else might have. But I don't understand normal drinkers. I was 6 years sober and I was with a priest who would nurse a drink, take a few sips, and walk away. And he did this one day, and every time he did it, I got angry in here. And I looked at him and I said, a good drink is supposed to be raped, not fondled, so get the hell with it. And that's my whole attitude toward how alcohol was supposed to be consumed. I needed it in here for the effect, so I slugged them down. And I had three powerfully big drinks, and then the effect started and life could begin. I blacked out all the time. I got the shake. I can still today just picture a bottle of whiskey and feel a control over me. It is absolutely impossible for me to exercise any control at all over alcohol. And yet, I told you that I'm sober. And I told you that not only am I sober, I'm serene. See, if you think that alcohol is the problem, being sober is surprising. But if you understand that alcohol isn't the problem, being sober and serene is the real surprise. The worst period of my life was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous, when the answer was out and only the naked problem remained. And I went through hell, absolute hell. Now, you know, I was a total neurotic for years before I started drinking, a borderline psychotic, I would say at least, and all of that just came right back at its worst. And I had nothing to drug me from it. And my God experience started rather fast because I think God knew that I was so mentally screwed up that I couldn't last long without an answer. I cried for help in November. I sobered up in May. I wrote to the diocese to see if I could get a psychiatrist. And they recommended the best psychiatrist that I've ever heard of, and the man was fabulous. And that was necessary, because see, that was the only thing I worshipped. And I needed a shrink that didn't fail me at all, because if that man had any weakness at all, I'd blame my pain on his weakness. And he did everything. He was powerfully spiritual. We use him for most of our sick priests and nuns, which probably keeps him very busy. I'll tell you how great he was. As I shared with you, my turnaround came rather dramatically. He didn't think it could last, and I didn't. But after it lasted 2 weeks, this is what the man said. He said, "Larry, you don't have to see me anymore. Alcoholics Anonymous has given you in 4 weeks what I hoped 2.5 more years of intensive therapy might have given you." He gave total control to the program, took no credit at all. Now, a man who can do that is a great man. And just, I haven't found it necessary to see him at all since that date. So, this past November, when things were hectic, I started thinking back to 12 years before, when I was an absolute basket case, drinking, boozing, taking pills, and just dead inside. And I saw how I was walking on top of the water, and that was a nice thought. I started meditating on the Peter incident, and neat little things were happening. But then all of a sudden, my sponsor has a swimming pool. And for some reason, driving in my car to get to the law school, I have an hour and 10-minute drive, and I pray the rosary, which simply means I will use beads in a spirit of prayer to think, to put myself in a constant meditation so I constantly come back after all my distractions. The beads just keep bringing me back so that I'm not going to think about the driving and everything else. Again and again and again, I come into what I'm trying to think about God doing for me. I thought of this swimming pool, and I thought of myself literally standing on top of the swimming pool. And ever since then, that story has had a new meaning. That's absolutely impossible. Absolutely impossible. And that's exactly what it is for me to stand in front of you sober today. And see, it's easy for me when I've been sober 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years to reach a point where I feel, hey, I know a lot, and that's why I'm sober, to take my sobriety for granted. But if I think about standing on top of a swimming pool for 11 years, I don't think a sane person could believe he was standing there on his own strength. And that shakes me back into really understanding I don't belong here, and you don't belong here either. That you're looking at a miracle, and I'm looking at a room full of miracles. And I've got to see it with this surprise. I've got to wonder why. And just have that sense of awe at the fact that I'm on top of the water. And it's just so neat. So what I'm going to do is walk through the rest of the steps, looking at them from the aspect of this swimming pool, Peter walking on the water. When Hardy gave me a tour of Jonesboro, we came up on the rice mill, and he told me that it either is the largest or the second largest rice mill in the world, depending upon which one may have made later additions or not. And we came on it from an angle where it didn't look big at all. And then we went through it and around it and saw it from another angle, and it's just awesome. That's exactly what I'm going to mean. I'm not going to give you the basic meaning of a lot of the steps this morning. I'm going to give you another aspect, another angle, that each of these new aspects from thinking about the walking on the swimming pool have meant more for me in my life, and maybe they can touch some of your life. Shortly after I had this thought, I was at a meeting of my own home group. It was a Wednesday night meeting, which is probably the neatest meeting we've got. I just called it my home group. I just had a shift. That's real nice. I'm in the same group as Jim and Vinoy, the big book group in Norman, Oklahoma. I live in Sterling. There's no group at all in Sterling. And I go to Lawton, where I sobered up for two meetings, and two meetings in Norman. I looked around, and we were getting ready to start a meeting. Everybody was introducing themselves. There were about 100 people in a circle. And it suddenly occurred to me that I could picture that whole room of people sitting on chairs, as all of us being out in the middle of a huge lake, sitting on top of the water. And every one of them suddenly became new for me. They became a visible sign of a powerful expression of God. How can we all sit around so content? Newcomers who have their, you know, they've got their head up their butt. They don't know where they are. They don't know what's going on. Old-timers in messes. Old-timers with a lot of serenity. People in between making all sorts of mistakes. 13-stepping. All sorts of weird things. And yet we're all sitting around this room and we're all serene. I mean, we're all sober. What a powerful expression of God's power. And see, I need to remember that. Because the second step is absolutely crucial for me to remember that it doesn't offer me sobriety, it offers me sanity, and that's an awful lot more. Sanity comes from the Latin word sanus. And that's healthy, whole, entire, complete. And God's power is there to render me complete, healthy, holy, entire, saintly someday. This life or the next life, it's not important. And I need that when I start giving up. And I've got a lot of problems. I'll share two of them with you. One is a sexual problem that constantly recurs. And it's in the area of dealing with pornography. And I've had it for most of my life. And I just hate myself so much for it. And when it comes back, I just feel it's been here. And I've been sober 11 years. This has to go. And I'm all ready to just quit and give up and give in. But if I remember the power that's present in this room, if I look out at you and I see that you're all sitting on top of the water, we're all here together, I can't believe. It's impossible for me to picture the power of God that's at my disposal. How can I ever lower my standards and say it will never be better or it's always going to be this way? The second step smashes despair, despondency, and complacency, and they are always knocking at the door of my life. I tend to be exceptionally efficient. And when I have to put in like 16, 17, 18-hour days, it's very difficult not to be. And when I get efficient, people stop existing. Possibly the worst example I can share with you that I've done with this recently was right before law school started, I had an entire Saturday where I would be going, like I got up at about 5 in the morning, and I was going to be going until about 10 o'clock at night. And one of the things I was doing was driving about a mile and a half to visit a woman who was dying so I could take her communion, just visit with her as a priest. And I was surprised she was still alive because they called me over the afternoon before and they thought she was at the point of dying. And I had been visiting her very regularly. I walked into the home and two of her children were there. There were four children. And I said, "How's Mary?" And they said, "She died about midnight." And I just instantly clicked efficient. First thing was to see Mary. Mary was dead. I crossed it off my list. The next thing was simply, all I did was tell them, "Well, given my schedule, I'm sorry I have to say this, but if the only time's unavailable, the wake service must be Sunday, the funeral must be Monday morning." And I turned around and walked out. Didn't say a thing to them. And one of them has a lot of emotional problems, and he'll probably never have enough love again in the world through life. And I got in my car, and I started driving away, and it just suddenly hit me how horrible that was. I can do that again and again and again. Now, when I see something like this, and I see a record of this in my life, the easiest thing is to give in. And if I give in, I'm giving up. But I don't give in if I remember the power. And see, my second step can be based not only on what God is doing for me, but on what God is doing for us. When I look at all of us sitting around on a Sunday morning, isn't that just impossible? A bunch of sober drunks getting up early on a Sunday morning to laugh and be happy? It's not supposed to happen. And when I see that power, I can deepen my own second step. I shared the way I'm sharing with you for the first time last Saturday. And since then, I've had changes, deeper experiences using this kind of thought of being on top of a swimming pool and really picturing it on three of the steps. And one of them dealt with the third step. It just occurred to me that, you know, if I'm on top of the water, how simple the third step becomes. Most people, like me, I think, start off with this feeling the third step deals with what we give up. Made a decision to turn our will and our life over to God. And that isn't what the step says at all. It says, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. You know, it's like, here I am on top of the pool. I can't do nothing to keep me up here. So all I should do is relax and enjoy it. I don't fight alcohol. Fighting alcohol is like pushing a patent tank. If I'm pushing it the way it's going, I'm not going to help it much. And if I push it against the way it's going, I'm just going to get rolled over. Just relax and enjoy what's happening. And sort of We had a birthday in our group about 2 weeks ago, and we celebrate birthdays in a very big way, and I like that a lot. And I gave the gal a little medal off a phrase. A Catholic priest wrote a song saying, "I will never forget you, my people. I have carved you in the palm of my hand." It's off a phrase from the prophet Isaiah. And because the song has caught on in our church, it's a really neat song. Somebody has a little statue and a little medal of a big hand and a child just cuddled and resting in it. And that is just so neat. And that's the picture, the feeling that I got. What's the third step? I'm on top of the water. I don't know how I got here, but it's neat. And all I'm going to do is relax. Relax in the power that's keeping me here. And just let it all start happening. And that is just so very, very healthy for me. The comments I want to make on this will kind of maybe round out my views on alcoholism and the fact that I have no choice. I hear people talk about how we're free today, and I don't believe that. I don't believe today I am free to stoke up a furnace, to open the furnace door then and put my hand in and hold it there. That is an absolutely insane action, and I don't believe a sane person can make a free choice to do an insane action. I believe as badly physically burned as I would be from the stoker, I honestly believe all of us here in this program know we will be that badly spiritually and emotionally burned if we go back to drinking. I don't believe I can make a rational choice for an insane action. I believe the return to drinking is actually the product of a return to insanity that comes from a failure to work the program. And just on that, let me then also share that I hear people talk at meetings about the fact that how good the program works, and if the program didn't work, they'd go back to drinking. And I feel very sorry for those people because they forgot something. They forgot the most important thing. They came here because alcohol had stopped working. And the experience of Alcoholics Anonymous is once it stops working, it never starts working again. And alcohol, therefore, is simply not a viable choice again for me. It's just impossible. No matter how bad things get, there is only one thing I know. If I drink, it'll be worse. And I've been in places in this program where that's all I knew. I had nothing to be grateful for except the fact that I wasn't drunk on adding that extra layer of pain. And that puts me in this position that I told you about. I don't have the choice to drink. Alcohol will never solve my problems again, and I can't kill myself. So the only thing I can do, I'm pressured, is to work this program, to force myself to work this program, so that I will stay sane enough to allow that power to keep me above the water. The fourth step, the inventory step, looking at ourselves, from the view of being on top of the water, makes an entire new picture come to me. If God is keeping a neat, loving, simple man, like I picture Francis of Assisi to be, on top of the water, that's neat. If God is keeping a priest who was blessed with a good family, received a good education, went to Penn State. That's for the... We have a nun present here who went to Pitt. I got the podium. She doesn't. That'll give her an incentive to work. That'll give her an incentive to work the program so that someday she can get behind a podium and have equal time. Given a priest who went to Penn State, given every blessing and stowed every cent in the poor fund, has lust, has greed, has selfishness, materialism. If I'm on top of that water, that's an entirely different picture of God. Coming to see who I am is crucially important for me, therefore, to understand the love that God has for me. Therefore, for me to see my whole self becomes real important. I'm 5'10". If I felt that I had to be 6'2", imagine, for you to like me, imagine the tension I would be under. If I felt that I had to be 5'6", for you to like me, imagine the pressure I'd be under. If I felt I had to be both of these, with that tension and that pressure, I could never know peace. See, when I meet any group of people and deal with God, I feel I'm not supposed to be 5'10". I've told you, I have lusts. Priests aren't supposed to have lusts. So I'm supposed to be smaller than this. And in my sexual urges, I'm only supposed to be 5'6", or 5, rather than 5'10". I don't like children. Can't stand them. Priests are supposed to like children. So I try to change what I am inside and have more love than I do. I hate visiting people in the hospital because I never know how I'm going to be received, and I'm that insecure to constantly open the door and face absolute rejection from a stranger just knocks me over. Priests are supposed to like visiting the sick, so I try to be taller than I am. The only way I'm going to have peace is to know, as far as my lust is concerned, I'm 5'10 today. As far as anything else is concerned, I'm 5'10 today. And that's the size I'm supposed to be. I get a lot of help from this, of thinking of the Oklahoma fields. Our farmers have planted their wheat. When it's going to be harvest in June, it's going to be about that tall. It's going to be golden, and it's going to be coming to a head. If I walk into the fields today, it's about like 2 inches high, it's scraggly, it's green, and it has no head. But you see, that's where it's supposed to be to get through the winter. And I look at myself and I think I'm supposed to be golden, totally tall, and coming to a head. And I look at so many areas in my life where I'm green and scraggly, and I'm just so small, and there's no head at all. And what I've got to remember is that God has his own timetable, and I really got to somehow believe I'm exactly the size he wants me to be at this time of my life. And so, if I see the size I am, if somehow I can force myself to really see where I'm at, if I can just say, hey, with 11 years sober, it's okay for me just to be like this. I don't have to compete with anyone else. And see the defects when they crop up. Yesterday, I had a bad day. I didn't get my meditation in the day before. I didn't get my daily inventory in. And I was just irritable with everybody. About 2 or 3 times in the course of the day, I wanted to strangle people that were upsetting me so much. I reached over so sharp. I didn't want to see that when I wrote that last night. God, it's not supposed to be me. I'm not supposed to stand up and, you know, try to talk to people spiritually on a Sunday morning and be a crud on Saturday afternoon. But it is me. And I'm the person God is keeping sober, and it gets more shocking when I see who I am to understand the love God has. And then the fifth step takes on a different aspect. You know, here I am standing on top of the water. Supposing what I did was cover everything from my head down so you wouldn't see my defects, and all you saw was this little shining halo I tried to put up here. You wouldn't see the pitchfork and the tail in my hand. You know, the little devilish part of me. You wouldn't have a lot of reason to think God was doing a lot. The fifth step, admitting to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, eventually is the way that I've received the strength to stand open as the total person that I am to the whole world, allowing the world, whenever it has a need, to see me as I am. You know, it's one thing if you think that God is keeping me sober because, oh, as a priest, I pray every day. I don't. You know, as a priest, I go visit the sick, and I don't. As a priest, I love children, and I don't. It's another thing if you understand that God is keeping me sober despite all the blessings that I've had, how I've slapped them in the face with them, cursed them, stolen from them, and done everything else. You understand God's power in a much deeper and a much more meaningful way. And I owe it to the God that's keeping me above the water to allow you to see that the person standing on top of the water isn't a plastic saint, but just a very real person. The sixth step, entirely ready to have God remove all these defects. For me, this step ends my schizophrenia, my sobriety schizophrenia. Because you see, I think that I am supposed to be, in God's love, on top of the water, someone who works with people I sponsor, someone who will try to share where I'm at any given moment, someone who will listen to fifth steps, someone who, because I've hurt that badly, can hurt other people. But I don't think, when I'm on top of the water, that I'm supposed to be someone with a real greed for money, a real laziness, a real intolerance of people, once I've given them an answer, who don't pick it up and run with it and instantly be solved and cured. You know, I allow them to touch the hem of my garment and they stay sick. And I don't like that. And so what I want is I want just parts of me to stand on top of the water. And that isn't what's happening. The sixth step is for me a challenge to be just a person. My God does not make labels. He makes people. And it isn't labels that he keeps on top of a water, on top of a swimming pool. It's a person. It's Larry who is standing here. And so when I see things in myself that I don't like, the answer ultimately is to just know I am just only going to have to be me. And to really find a simplicity in this and an ability to love and accept myself. Yesterday, as I was getting together my ideas to share with you, I'm thinking through the steps, and I kind of outline what I want to share on paper, and then I don't bring it. I've done my work, and by not bringing it, I try to stay open so that God can do his work, and if I blank out, whatever happens once I've done my work, I can give God the total credit and blame for it. Because I've done my work. Yesterday something happened and I had an entirely new insight into the seventh step. The sixth step is I'm ready to stand on top of the water. The seventh step humbly asked God to remove our shortcomings. That means somehow I take an active role in this. And what does that really mean? Somehow I'm going to be active in wanting to be the person who's standing on top of the water. Now as I translate that for me, you know what that really means? I'm going to ask God to make me willing to want to like Larry as he is. That's heavy. You know, here God is working a miracle for Larry, and I don't like me. God obviously does. One of us has a bad set of values. I don't know how I'm going to get the point across to him, so he changes. And what this really means is I'm not only going to be ready, I'm going to be active. I am really going to be willing to ask God to give me this last ability to want to just be Larry, to stand here, not the best-looking guy, not the ugliest guy, not the best member of Alcoholics Anonymous, not the worst member of Alcoholics Anonymous, not the best priest and not the worst priest, but the best Larry there is today. God sees me as, you know, I am the best me there is. And I've got to see that, because that's how God sees it. He'll never, ever make another person, and he could have done everything different about me. I am precisely who he wants me to be when I'm born and without, this is my understanding, in every moment of my life. So what you see is what God wants. And I've got to want to be the person God wants. And it's so simple. Not to want to be more of anything. You see, I believe my God is real. And reality doesn't love dreams. Reality loves reality. And the only person you can love is a person. And God loves me. Not what I think I'm supposed to be. And I've got to get into this flow. And the seventh step, if I picture myself on top of the water, that God is keeping me here, I can want to be that person that God is keeping there. Just that person. And, of course, that'll make me better in God's plan. The eighth step, made a list of all persons we had harmed. I think every one of you can understand this. When you're literally drowning, you can't think of anyone else. And I've been drowning really my entire life, certainly from the age of 14 on. It was impossible for me to be aware of the feelings in any other person, unless that person was there that I could cling to, pulling them down but keeping me on top of the water, somehow that I could manipulate them. And now that I'm up, now that God is keeping me up, it's time that I'm not drowning and I'm not in fear of drowning for me to become aware of you and where you're at and the feelings you have. And that is so rough and that's so difficult for me to get out of my own fears, to get out of my own insecurities and just try to sit and listen. It's one of the greatest steps. The eighth step has as its single biggest byproduct for me, discovering that you have feelings. I badly hurt people trying to do good for them, telling them to do things they weren't ready to do. I had a gal that I shared a great spiritual step that I just made with, completely forgetting how delicate her own sobriety was. She couldn't do that, and she thought that meant she was an absolute total failure, and she fell apart. And it took 3 hours of gentle talking to put her back where she was before I opened my mouth. I don't learn from my mistakes. I've done the same thing to other people since then very, very regularly. But occasionally, I can really hear where the person is, and I can have the strength to know where they're at and deal with them where they're at. I shut my mouth for 3 years with someone I sponsored because they weren't ready to hear of a very obvious defect in their life, because they weren't ready to take a look at it yet. And when the moment came, and there was enough growth in love, I shared it, and there was a big jump forward, because at that time I could be aware of where somebody else was. But that doesn't happen easily for me. I come in here, and I'm just so hurtful, and it's so easy to forget where people are at. Our Al-Anon speaker shared this so well, because younger people can cruelly hurt each other laughing, but so can older people. I remember chairing a meeting in a town where we had two Joes, and somebody was quoting another Joe, and he said, because they were both at the meeting, he said, you know, what Fat Joe said. And I stopped right away and I said, you know, I am so open to physical hurt because I've been crushed so much about my ears. I could not mention my ears to anyone when I was 28 years old. It's literally impossible for me to use the words. The scar was that big and in here. I loved long hair. I was a real hippie priest because the hair covered the ears, but the program covers the defect. And this also taught me something else that's very important, my ears. I could look in the mirror and see that, hey, they stick out a little. But I felt they went from wall to wall. And what that taught me is reality for anybody starts with their feelings. You could be the best-looking person here, but if you feel ugly, that's where your reality starts. You could be one of the greatest members of Al-Anon, but if you feel a failure, that's where your reality starts, and that's where I deal with people that I sponsor. I don't care what reality is with anybody. I want to know what their feelings are, because that's where they are to start touching them. And it's this eighth step that enables me to start slowly becoming aware of things like this and dealing with people. And there are no Fat Joes. People come here with all of their barriers down. This is the one place that to a person, I feel you're going to want to love me. And so I just expose myself. And rejections in Alcoholics Anonymous hurt me much deeper than anywhere else because I am exposed to be hurt. And I really believe that what is true for me is true of other people. And so I hope we can be super careful. You know, I'm a compulsive overeater. I haven't taken a snack now between meals for 8 years. And when I start eating, I start eating. And I've had people who were kind enough to tell me, hey, you're putting on weight. Let me tell you that by the time anyone has put on enough weight for you to notice it, they have noticed it themselves. And they don't really need the kindness of your paying attention to them. It doesn't help them with their pain at all. And I really believe there isn't a person here that if we look at long enough, we can't find something positive to say about their smile, their dress, their hair, anything. And those are the things we need to hear, because those are the things that support each other. The ninth step, so I'm on top of the water, and I now have a miracle to share with you. And the ninth step is my removing anything that's going to keep me from being effective in your life. If I've put a barrier that keeps you from seeing the miracle God is making of me, I just want to go and wash that away. Because I want to be somehow open to allowing this power that's doing such drama in my own life to allow this power to come through and touch you. And it makes the step real positive and real, real helpful for me. Seeing who I am and, that I am supposed to be a message to the world. The tenth step, Jim talked about really being at his first wife's grave. I forgot where else we heard it, of people who have been sober and returned to drink. And we had it again and again and again in the talks that we've heard. There's a reality to this program that those of us who have been here a while have seen. The fact that I'm above the water today doesn't mean I'm going to be above the water tomorrow. There's nothing guaranteed. I cannot guarantee my sobriety tomorrow. I think Joe made this point again just last night. And it's so important for me. I refuse to guarantee tomorrow's sobriety. Because I think that anybody who says that is on the road to trouble because they're saying they can keep themselves on top of the water. I was in a club where they celebrate birthdays early. They celebrate them like the last Thursday of the month, the last Sunday of the month. And should there be a few more days and your birthday fall after that date, they'll celebrate it. And I was twice ordered by a group to celebrate my birthday early, and I refused to do it. If I, on the 20th of May, celebrate my birthday on the 21st of May, I'm saying I can stay sober tomorrow. And I'm going to the very heart of our program because that's the first step. And I can't guarantee that at all. And I mean that with everything that I am. And the only way I'm going to celebrate a birthday on the 21st of May is by knowing I can't anticipate it by a single day and doing what I can today to allow God to keep me above the water today. The 11th step, just this also has changed since I shared last Saturday. And if you think of all the things that these little meditations have added to me, thinking of myself and all of you just on the top of water, what does all this add up to? I'm being loved. I'm up here and I don't know why. I haven't done anything. I really haven't. There's so much power. There's so much wonder has been coming in my life. All that means that God loves me. And this is what the 11th step is. Let me, as a clergyman, just share some terms for me and give you an example. Prayer is talking and meditating is listening. Now, I didn't find God, remember. I found the program. I found sponsors. I had sponsors before I had the program. So from sponsors to program to steps to God. And you know that's still the only way for me to understand God, to work any step that deals with God, is to go back into that same set of channels. So let me just take a group. If I come before you and I give you the impression that God's in heaven and everything's rosy on earth and that I'm Mr. AA and that I don't have any problems and I don't have any lust and I don't have any sexual difficulties and I don't have any greed and I'm, I'll 12-step anybody anytime and I've always said yes to anybody in the program, then when you accept me, nothing good happens. I spend two nights a week with my sponsor because he lives where the law school is. And I had kind of flipped out sexually kind of recently and for about a two-week period didn't tell him this. And, being around him was uncomfortable because he was accepting me and I knew I didn't deserve it because he didn't know what a crud I was. And so I just went and told him. And he didn't say anything, but I just told him. Praying is Larry presenting Larry. Then whatever you do, if I just listen to your acceptance, you're loving me. And when I just share where I'm at and who I am, and you don't all get up in mass and walk out, you're staying here because you're accepting me. And now I can feel loved, and that can be a powerful thing. I'm going to do something, and I'm going to share with you a meditation. Because we don't do this enough. I believe where there is love, there is God. Love in the sense of a process, remember, an activity. And every so often at an AA meeting, people are sharing deeply. And I pull away from the meeting and I go into a meditation. It just has happened. I never plan it. And it's worked super well. It's taught me a lot of things I need to hear. The first time, because see, if there's a lot of sharing, God is so present here. Greater love than this has no man than to lay down his life for his friends, the Bible says.
Everybody else shares their successes. What do we share? We have the courage to share like Vinoy, to walk through all that pain and just hold it up so that it can heal someone else. And this is what really heals, not our successes, but our failures. I have this great joke, you know, what really heals a person? You come to AA and say, hey, you know, I had sex with a whale, and you think you're the only person on earth that ever had sex with a whale. And if you're in a group that's big enough, you're going to have one killer whale over here and two whites over there. And you just walk away feeling, I'm not so different. I got fired. Now, if you heard me make a comment about some nuns, I got fired by nuns. 9.5 years sober. Priests don't get fired. I mean, you just don't. My little aside is, I wish I'd gone down to collect unemployment. And, you know, they said, what do? I priest. We don't have much demand for them these days. It just isn't much call. I thought that I was innocent in getting fired, and it took me 2 years of growth to reach a point where I really won peace for them. But, you know, I don't want to be the instrument bringing it yet. But the real neat thing was I went to my sponsor, and he told me how he got fired 10 years sober. And boy, that didn't change anything, but it changed everything. That really hurt me. I'd never been fired in my life. And he was only fired once in his life. But his sharing that really healed, and that's the kind of love that we get in and through this program. So where there's this love, I can meditate. And my meditation started off just picturing a little bit of dirt. It was a backyard. I don't know how I knew that, because there's nothing but the dirt and a little tree like about 2.5 feet tall, no leaves, nothing on it. It's a fruit tree. And somehow I knew the tree was me, and the Lord came out, and I really felt he should spit on it, because there were no leaves, it was so ugly, and no fruit. And he went over and he hugged it, and that's all. About 6 months later, I'm back, and the same thing happens again, and I understand that the tree, it's winter. And I grew up in Pennsylvania, and in winter, trees can't have their leaves in the winter, because the snow would break the branches off. So in the right season, it's just not supposed to have leaves. And the tree was only 2.5 years old, and fruit trees aren't supposed to bear fruit that young, because the branches can't take the weight. So I was exactly where I was supposed to be. About 6 months later, it occurred to me that there was once a time when the redwoods were that size. And when they were that size, that was because that was the size God wanted them to be that day. And there was such a peace in there. I honestly believe I am not 1 inch taller and 1 inch smaller than God wants me to be for my own good today. Now, I can't feel that very often, but I can live it and accept it at times in and through the program. And then that whole kind of just thought just kept growing and growing and growing, and the tree was going to be moved. And that hurt so much, because to move the tree would cut into its roots, and it was painful. But the tree was being moved because it wasn't getting enough sunlight, and there was more growth wanted for it, and it had to be relocated. And the fact that it was being moved meant that God had his eye on it and wanted things to happen. Those things that happen, I don't like them at all. All of this leads in to the 12th step. The 12th step of the program. Much more has happened in that meditation, but it's always been what I need to experience more than what I need to share. With all this happening, with me standing on top of the water, watching people drown, watching children who are painful, who have the disease, watching someone I sponsor kill himself, watching people who have had long-term sobriety go back and drink. Right now, we have two priests, one of the most important ones in our diocese, has been dried out for the second or third time. Another one who they've spent about, I guess, close to $100,000, I'm sure. It's just as bad as he ever was. It helps me understand the pain that's out there and, you know, the real potential we have in our program. How can I be on top of the water and watch you drown and not care? Somehow I got to forget the miracle that's happening. And if I understand that I'm standing on a swimming pool and see that you're drowning down there and I do absolutely nothing, somehow I can't know where I'm at. And it also, for me, puts things in such a simple perspective. I can't cause you to walk on top of the water. I cannot carry the person. I can only carry the message. I can tell you the things I did to be lifted up. And hopefully that would get you in the same place I am. I want to share two more stories. They'll be very brief. One is more for the Al-Anon. Bible stories also. And I hope you hear that I'm not sharing these as inspired stories so that those of you who don't read the Bible, who don't believe that this book is inspired in any way, won't be offended, because I'm not taking them as authority. But just the example of the stories have meaning for all of us. There's a wonderful story that starts the 5th chapter of John, where there's a person who is paralyzed. I'd rather lying beside a pool. And the Lord walks up. And this is almost the whole literal story that occurs. The Lord looks at the person and says, do you want to be healed? And the response is, I have no one to put me in the pool. Before I get there, someone else is in the water. And the Lord says, pick up your mat and walk. I don't know if you've heard what I've just shared, because I missed it countless times myself. The Lord says, do you want to be healed? And the response wasn't yes. It was an excuse for staying sick and self-pity. Now, alcoholics certainly do this, but Al-Anon's a genius at it, and I have a total Al-Anon personality. I feel I can share this. You know, do you want to be healed? Here, love walks into your life and says, do you want to be healed? And what's the response? But you don't understand how much he's drinking. But you don't understand how sick my children are. But you don't understand, I'm going to law school, and I have 3 parishes to take care of, and I have people I sponsor. I've got to respond. You want to be a priest? That's not a question. And then self-pity. Oh, God, how I can dote in that. I spent 11 years pitying myself for the way the Catholic Church treated me. And I did an inventory on this last year. And then when I got all that self-pity out of my system, then I looked at the way I treated the Catholic Church, and I was astounded. It was just like me and my mother. I got a lower grade in the way I dealt with the church, then in honesty I had to give the church for the way it dealt with me, and I set myself up for most of the pain. I would say the things that would cause me to be knocked down. This is the challenge all of us have. There's a very simple kit of tools. They're not really complex. A 63-year-old guy made the best distinction I ever heard between simple and easy. He said when he was 7 years old, his dad took him out to the cotton fields and put a burlap sack around his shoulders, and he said, son, you picked the white ones. And he said those directions were as simple as could be, but they sure as hell weren't easy. The instructions in our program are very simple. That does not make them easy. But they are simple. And that's the challenge. We don't care how much your husband is drinking and your children are using and you know, all the other problems that are facing you today. The question is, love is facing you, not them, with that request. Do you want to be healed? And the neat thing is, even when we come up with the excuses and the self-pity, we're still given the invitation to be healed. The guy didn't say yes, and love said, pick up your mat and walk. And walk, incidentally, is take the steps that will enable you to be healthy. I enjoy winding away from people with a story that has a lot of meaning for me. It's also in the Gospel of John, and I just forgot the chapter, which would humiliate me. I think it's either 9 or 11. The Lord has a friend who dies named Lazarus, and he comes to the tomb, and he stands outside the tomb, and he calls out, Lazarus, come forth. Lazarus had been wrapped with little strips, and he walks out totally bound, and then the end of the story is, and he looked at them and said, untie him and let him walk free. Now that's fascinating. Because first, it keeps for me the correct relationship between God and me in working with other people. And I confuse that all the time. You have not called me out of my cave of death, and I was dead in there for at least 21 years. You didn't have the power to do that. And you haven't done it, and you're not doing it today. That's kind of the one time I thought you did. But I know today that only the power greater than myself that I choose to call God can bring me from my death to life. But you have a mission. When I came out of that death, I was paralyzed. I just spent 9 months bound in my own room. I couldn't face anybody ever. I could not walk through this life emotionally, even physically. With love, you have been unbinding me. And at first I learned to crawl, and then I learned to take some halting steps, and at certain times I can make full walking strides. But the job isn't done for me, and the job isn't done for you. But it helps us hear our mission. You know, we have Alateens who are bound yet, bound by so many scars. And they need to hear, untie her and let her walk free. We have Al-Anons with drinking alcoholics and Al-Anons with sober alcoholics and Al-Anons with using children. We have them in AA, those same Al-Anons, and they're being bound the same way. And they need to hear that same simple message. Untie him and let him walk free. And we have it certainly in our own program. It gives us our destiny and it gives us our humility. For 11 years and in 2 days, 6 months, God has been calling me from death to life, enabling me to walk on top of the water. For 11 years and almost 6 months, through this period of time, with your love,
You have enabled me to walk freer and freer and freer. I thank you very, very much.